When you think about the Vietnam War, often it's the big bases, the major
Right.
campaigns that come to mind.
The headlines.
Exactly. But today we're peeling back a layer, looking at a place that was, well, deliberately hidden. A top secret airbase carved right out of the jungle in Thailand. Nakhon Phanom, or NKP.
Ah, NKP. Yeah, it's got this real air of mystery around it.
Yeah.
And the stories are fascinating.
They really are. And for this deep dive, we found a fantastic source. It's a YouTube video, episode 47 from the Military Tales channel.
Okay.
It features a C-123K crew chief and a loadmaster talking about their time specifically at NKP. Gives you a real ground-level feel.
Oh, that's perfect. First-hand accounts are always the best for getting a sense of what it was really like. So our mission here is basically to unpack their experiences from that episode, see what life was like on this clandestine base.
That's the plan. We're focusing just on what these two guys shared in that video. Their names are Dan Pierce. He was a crew chief on the C-123K Candlestick flare missions.
Candlestick, okay.
And Mike Seitz, who was a loadmaster and also a flare kicker, as they call
Flare
it.
kicker, got it.
And the interesting thing is, they were there around the same time, roughly August 70 to August 71, but didn't actually know each other back then.
Wow. On a base like that, you'd think. But maybe not, given the secrecy.
Exactly. So let's start with them getting there. Their first impressions are pretty telling. Mike, the loadmaster, he talked about flying in on a C-130.
Right.
And they stop at these other bases first, places that were like fortresses, heavily guarded. So by the time he lands at NKP, this place carved out of the jungle, he said it felt like the end of the world.
I can imagine. Just reinforces how remote and, well, different NKP must have felt compared to the more established bases.
Totally. And Dan, the crew chief, he had a different kind of initial shock. He came from working on jets.
Okay, modern
Yeah.
stuff.
And he gets to NKP and sees mostly propeller planes, C-119s, C-47s, the C-123s he worked on.
Yeah.
He actually said it felt like going back in time.
Huh. That's quite a contrast. Makes you think about the kinds of missions they were running out of there, needing those specific, maybe older aircraft types.
Personally specialized. And both of them, Dan and Mike, they really hammer home the secrecy in that video discussion, the compartmentalization.
Yeah. How so?
Well, Mike mentioned just being amazed at how little people in one section knew about what others were doing,
Yeah.
like different squadrons, different jobs, very little crossover.
That extreme level of need to know.
Right. And Dan backs this up. He said his C-123s, the Candlesticks, were parked right near the Jolly Green Giant helicopters.
The rescue guys, HH-53s.
Yeah, and the A-1 Sky Raiders, the prop attack planes. But he said at the time, he had basically no idea what their specific missions were, like the downed pilot extractions. He just knew they were there.
Just parked next door, but worlds apart in terms of operational knowledge.
Exactly. And get this, Dan said he was at NKP for 6 months before he even found out there was a special ops group operating on the same base.
6 months. Wow. That really speaks volumes about the operational security. The clandestine nature of NKP they were talking about in that episode.
It really does. So let's talk about those missions Dan and Mike were directly involved in, the Candlestick flare missions. Even though they didn't know each other then, their roles were intertwined.
Okay, so what was the main job of Candlestick? Illuminating things, presumably.
Pretty much. These were night missions, primarily supporting bases in Nor Yeng Laos, often CIA-run outposts, apparently. The goal was to light up the area, either to deter enemy attacks or to spot targets, like trucks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Makes sense. Dropping flares to turn night into day, basically.
Right. And these flares were serious business. According to Dan in the video, they carried 100 per mission.
100. That's a lot of light.
Yeah, and each one was 3 million candle power. They'd drop them in pairs, flying this steady circular pattern at about 12,000 feet. Each flare burned for around 3 minutes.
3 million candle power burning for 3 minutes. That provides sustained illumination over an area. So, Mike, as the loadmaster and flare kicker, he'd be the one physically getting these things out the door.
That was a key part of the loadmaster job on those flights, yeah. But it wasn't just about the flares. Dan mentioned they also dropped colored marker boxes
Markers. For what?
to guide the fighter jets. They'd use combinations like red and yellow or red and green to mark specific points for the fighters coming in to strike targets.
Nah, target marking for the fast movers.
Exactly. And they also had starlight scopes on board the C-123K.
Night vision, basically.
Right, to spot movement on the ground, especially trucks on the trail. They could then radio that info to coordinate bombing runs. It was all interconnected.
So the candlestick wasn't just dropping light, it was acting as an observation platform and coordinating attacks, too. very precise work, especially at night.
Extremely precise. Dan talked about maintaining their orbit at 12,000 feet while fighters were often higher, maybe 20,000 feet. Coordination was key.
And dangerous, I imagine. Any close calls?
Well, they both mentioned the constant threat. There was that tragic incident before their time where a B-66 collided with a C-123. That definitely hung over things.
Yeah, midair like that. Sobering.
And then there was the ground fire. That comes up a lot in their conversation in episode 47.
Anti-aircraft.
Oh, yeah. 23 millimeter, 37 mil, 57 mil, even 100 millimeter guns. And sometimes SAM's surface-to-air missiles.
Wow, against a C-123, that's not a fighter jet.
Not at all. Mike actually told this incredible story, maybe secondhand, but about a C-123 taking something like 5,000 rounds of small arms fire and surviving, and even taking a direct hit to the tail section and making it back.
5,000 hits. That's almost unbelievable. Shows how much lead could be thrown up at them.
Definitely. And Dan mentioned hearing about A-1 Skyraider pilots during their dives, seeing multiple 37 millimeter tracer rounds coming up at them. Apparently those took about 7 seconds to reach altitude.
7 seconds of watching tracers climb towards you. Intense. It sounds like dealing with ground fire was just part of the job description.
Pretty much unavoidable, especially on those low-level passes or when illuminating targets. Now, Dan also flew daytime missions, which he talks about in the episode, too.
Okay. Different kind of risk profile in daylight, I guess.
Yeah. These were flights often originating from Tan Son Hut up the coast of Vietnam. After dropping off cargo, maybe flares, they'd have to quickly reconfigure the plane.
Reconfigure how?
Pull out rollers, put in seats, you know, turn it from a cargo hauler into a transport for passengers or mail heading back.
Okay. Multipurpose.
But doing that in daylight, in what Dan called a big, slow-moving aircraft, he worried constantly about SAMs. He even asked in the video, like, how could a C-123 possibly dodge a SAM?
It's a valid question. Not exactly agile.
And he had some hairy moments. One time, the pilot saw muzzle flashes from the ground and just yanked the plane into a sharp bank, a really drastic maneuver. Dan said he almost got thrown right across the cargo bay.
Whoa. Just reacting instantly to the threat.
Exactly. And another time, even worse, he described the plane just suddenly dropping out of the sky, just fell.
Dropped. Like turbulence or...
More than that, it sounds like. Unsecured cargo went flying. People got hurt, passengers in the back. It was serious enough that when they landed, the aircraft had to undergo a full structural inspection.
Man, that sounds terrifying. Must have been some serious G-forces or airframe stress.
Yeah, you get the sense that even the routine flights weren't really routine. Always something.
Always on edge. Shifting gears a bit, but still related to those aircraft.
Yeah.
They discussed Agent Orange exposure in that episode, didn't they? That's a heavy topic.
It is, and very relevant because some of the C-123s, specifically the UC-123K and UK-123 models, had previously been used for ranch hand spraying missions.
Right, the planes that actually sprayed the defoliants.
Yeah, and some of those same planes were later transferred to NKP for cargo and flare missions after they stopped spraying.
So residual contamination was a real concern for anyone working on or flying in them.
Absolutely. Mike talked quite a bit about his fight to get a VA claim approved for diabetes, potentially linked to Agent Orange.
What was the issue? Proving exposure.
Proving he was even in Vietnam initially, can you believe it? He was at NKP in Thailand, supporting ops over Laos and Vietnam, but the initial paperwork shuffle said no record of him being in-country Vietnam.
That sounds incredibly frustrating. How did he resolve it?
He mentioned getting help from a historian at Maxwell Air Force Base. This historian had compiled lists detailing exactly which aircraft were deployed where and when, including those ex-ranch hand planes. That list was apparently crucial for Mike to finally connect the dots for his claim.
Wow. Good on that historian. But it shouldn't be that hard for veterans.
You'd think not. And Dan, as he shared in the video, is currently dealing with his own health issues, prostate cancer, type 2 diabetes, and pursuing VA claims, too.
Also potentially linked.
That's the concern. And he expressed this real regret, you know, wishing he'd kept meticulous records, like the tail numbers of every single plane he worked on.
Yeah, because he was a crew chief and also did flight line maintenance.
Exactly. So he figures he almost certainly worked on some of those former spray planes, but without the specific tail numbers logged from back then, proving that direct link now is really difficult.
Hindsight is tough. You don't think about keeping that level of detail decades later.
No, you don't. It's a tough situation. Then there's the homecoming experience, which they also touched upon. Very different for both of them.
How so?
Mike described his arrival back in the States as pretty sudden, unexpected almost, and the reception... Well, Not always positive. He mentioned getting some negative reactions from civilians about his service.
Yeah, that was unfortunately common during that era. A difficult time to come home.
It really was. Dan, on the other hand, said his return to northern Vermont was relatively quiet, uneventful.
Okay.
But here's something they both mentioned in the video, a shared experience.
Mm.
Neither of them really talked much about their service for years afterward. Not even with other veterans, really.
That internal compartmentalization continues even after leaving the military. Just bottle it up.
Seems like it. But then, much later, things started to change. They talked about how important reconnecting with other NKP veterans has been. Reunions, social media.
Finding that community again after decades.
Exactly. And how powerful that delayed camaraderie felt. They shared stories of finding guys from their old squadron, sometimes after 30 or 40 years. Some happy reunions, but also sad news. Finding out about guys who got sick or passed away.
Bittersweet, I guess. But that connection must mean a lot. Mike also mentioned something about loneliness, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Reflecting on leaving the military, that really structured environment, the shared mission, and then suddenly being out. He suggested some veterans felt quite lonely, adrift, almost, after that transition.
That makes sense. Losing that built-in support system and sense of purpose overnight.
For sure. It's also interesting hearing them talk about how NKP itself has changed.
The base. It's still there.
Well, the location is.
Yeah.
But the top secret airbase, it's now a civilian airport.
Wow. From clandestine operations to commercial flights, that's quite a transformation.
Isn't it? And the nearby city, Nakhon Phanom, has grown a lot, too. They estimated maybe 40,000 people now. There's even a friendship bridge connecting Thailand to Laos right there.
So quite developed compared to the jungle outpost they describe.
Yeah.
Have veterans gone back?
Yeah, they mentioned some have. And one story that stood out was a vet who felt he needed to go back for, quote, healing. To revisit this place that held so much fear and intensity for him back then.
A pilgrimage, almost. To process it all.
It kind of feels that way. They also briefly mentioned the infamous Monkey House.
The Monkey House? What's that?
The local Thai jail in Nakhon Phanom City. Apparently, it had a pretty harsh reputation. A reminder, they said, of the risks off base, especially getting involved with drugs, serious consequences in Thailand.
Right. Different country, different rules.
Yeah.
Good reminder.
One last thing that really struck me from their conversation was the unexpected connections they made long after the war.
Oh, yeah. Like bumping into people.
Exactly. Dan told two amazing stories in episode 47. First, he met a guy who had actually helped build NKP with the Red Horse Engineers.
Okay.
And it turns out, after they both got back to the States, this guy lived only 7 miles away from Dan. They had no idea for years.
7 miles apart after serving at the same remote base overseas. That's incredible. Small world.
Isn't it? And then another time, Dan was at a car show wearing an NKP hat. Another guy walks up, points at the hat. Turns out he was also Red Horse, also served at NKP. Just a chance encounter recognizing the hat.
Wow. Those shared experiences just create these invisible threads, I guess, popping up decades later.
It really seems that way. So wrapping up this deep dive into Dan and Mike's recollections from that specific YouTube episode, it really brings NKP to life, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You get a real sense of the secrecy, the intensity of it all, the specific dangers of those candlestick missions, the ground fire, the weirdness of the compartmentalization.
And the lasting impact, both the health concerns, like Agent Orange, but also those bonds between the veterans, even if they took decades to really surface.
Yeah, that delayed camaraderie is powerful. It leads you to think, doesn't it?
How so?
Well, reflecting on Dan and Mike's stories, you know, what does it really tell us about shared experience? Especially the tough ones, the ones people don't talk about for a long, long time.
Mm. Like how revisiting that past, connecting with others who were there, can maybe change your perspective or even offer some kind of healing.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder, how many other hidden histories like this are out there, just waiting in people's personal stories, like the ones these two veterans shared about NKP?